this lender is not going to be as patient with me or as understanding with me as a traditional lender because they might want to repossess the property.
All right, welcome back to Trade Secrets. We are excited to kick off another episode. Make sure you give us some likes and thumbs up on your favorite listening device to keep this thing going. Today's topic is an interesting one. We're going to talk about seller financing. We have had a lot of that coming up recently in our conversations with clients and deals, and we can get into if that's normal, abnormal, why it's happening, and all of those good things. But owner financing is the topic du jour. We're going to enjoy some Forrester 1870 along the way. And again, welcome. So thanks for listening, and we look forward to you enjoying the discussion about if seller financing is a good thing or a bad thing and who it impacts.
For who.
Yeah, for who. So, Paige, I think you've got some good questions lined up.
Yeah, because you're just looking at my notes.
No, I can't see your notes.
So this came up. A lot of projects we've been working on in the past year. I mean, in my experience, projects that I've been a part of in the past year, there have been buyers that come to the table and ask about seller financing. Or on the opposite side, you know, we've had someone looking, maybe the numbers aren't penciling and the buyer is offering seller financing. So my general question is, you know, I guess we all understand what seller financing is.
Well, I don't know that our listeners do. Yeah. Okay. So I think you should explain it. Yeah.
Very simply, seller financing is where a buyer obtains a mortgage from the seller rather than going through a traditional bank or a lender.
Kind of, sort of.
Yeah, not necessarily obtains the mortgage, but enters into a contractual agreement very similar to a mortgage.
Well, it could be both. It could be a mortgage or it could be a land contract, and we can talk about the differences in those two things. But I was actually just pointing out that it doesn't have to be the only mortgage. Like, seller financing can exist as a second or a third or a fourth or a fifth mortgage. Like, there's not kind of a universal that if it's seller financing, there is no other mortgage. So
that was the point I wanted to make. Was one of my questions, but I guess we can just go there now. So the seller having debt on the property does not impact their ability to enter into some kind of seller financing agreement with a new potential buyer.
Give me a for example.
Correct?
I think the answer is no, but give us an example.
So there's an owner of a multi-tenant triple net leased office property.
Okay.
They still have outstanding debt.
In round numbers, like, let's use a real world example. Let's say it's a $3 million property and they've got debt for $1.5 million.
Perfect.
Okay. So they've got 50% leverage on the property.
The buyer that wants to buy that property.
Yep.
But in our current climate, interest rates are very high.
Still hovering around like 7.5% for something like this. So
yeah,
high compared to what it was, but historically still remarkably affordable, but high compared to 24 months ago.
Sure.
I was going to say, let's make sure, like, keep it really real world scenario. The 50% or the $1.5 million of debt that the seller has, what's the interest rate? When did he get the debt?
He got the debt 8 years ago.
Okay, so he's got like 3.5% money, meaning he's borrowing $1.5 million at probably 3.5% interest.
Right.
Okay.
So that is obviously more.
His money
was less costly to borrow than a potential buyer now.
Mm-hmm.
So a potential buyer now would say, hey, I'm interested. I'm not making the numbers pencil at the ask price for this. So would the seller consider a seller financing arrangement?
Okay. And the simple answer is yes, the seller could still provide seller financing even though they had 50% of their value tied up in debt, with the caveat that they would need to subordinate that position to the bank. So they would definitely have to have the bank sign off on this concept. And they would probably have to do it via a mortgage that's less than 50% of the value, because I don't think the bank would agree to letting them provide a mortgage for more than that, or via a land contract, which would not require them to pay off their existing mortgage.
What is a land contract?
So the difference between seller financing in its traditional sense, where the property transfers, so the buyer actually, there's a closing and the title and the deed transfer to the buyer, but then a mortgage document is typically recorded. It should be recorded. If you're out there and you're thinking about providing seller financing and you do it via a mortgage, make sure you record it. We can come back to that, the why. Property actually transfers hands, and then the seller has a mortgage on the property and would be acting just like a bank and would have the same recourse options that a bank has when the buyer, for whatever reason, stops making payments, if that were to happen. In a land contract, the property doesn't transfer. So the seller retains ownership of the property, keeps the title, keeps the deed, but they enter into a contract that says, I'm going to make these payments. Typically, it's for 1 to 5 years, and then there's a balloon payment. And at that moment in time where the contract terms are all achieved, meaning the buyer has paid all those payments and or made the balloon payment, at that moment in time, the property transfers and title actually changes hands.
In your first scenario, though, because the bank's debt exists still, it's not paid off, the bank has a primary position. So technically, the seller of the property is, I would say, an unsecured creditor based on the debt that he gave the new purchaser, but he's actually obligated for the initial loan.
Right.
So that's not a very advantageous position for the seller of the property.
It would definitely be a scenario where seller would want to explore all other options before providing seller financing.
So is it safe to say that a rule, is it always the case where a seller can only provide seller financing for their equity value in the property?
Like, that's a safe general rule of thumb.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's probably more often explored, meaning seller financing or a land contract, when there is no debt currently in place.
Okay.
Because it complicates it.
The most advantageous way is to eliminate the debt. And
or the debt was never there.
Or the debt was never there. By way of example, if this guy just didn't want to go to the open market and he had $1.5 million to put on this property.
Who is this guy?
The buyer.
Of a $3 million property, of which he has $1.5 million worth of debt.
Seller has $1.5 million in debt.
Yeah. The buyer could pay the seller $1.5 million in debt, and the seller could provide finance
for the other million.
For the other $1.5 million.
And then the original debt that the seller had goes away, because he takes that $1.5 million he got from the buyer and gives it to the bank, and then he becomes the new bank. The reason that that's an unlikely scenario
is $1.5 million.
Is that buyers typically don't have 50% down payments and still want to do seller financing. If they've got the ability to write a check for 50% of the value of the building, strong probability they can get traditional bank financing.
Yeah, and why would... So in that scenario, buyer gives the seller the $1.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
And then that assumes that once the seller gives that to the bank, he has another $1.5 to lend to, or no, it's kind of like a note.
It's a note, right? It's so he doesn't note. Have the other $1.5 million. He doesn't give it to the buyer. The buyer just doesn't have to come up with the other $1.5 million. In a traditional sale, buyer would bring $1.5 million of equity or cash And then the buyer's traditional bank would fund the other $1.5 million. So at closing, the seller would get $3 million. In this scenario, the seller would get $1.5 million that he would immediately give to his bank. So he would never see that money. It would just pay off the debt. And he wouldn't get the other $1.5 million. He would just start receiving payments on the $1.5 million.
Okay.
And whatever so the terms are.
He would have a promise to pay secured by the real estate. Right. And we actually did have a situation recently where the purchaser was going to put 50% down but wanted a significantly reduced interest note for the other half of the property.
Which is a common request.
Yes, a common request.
By the buyer who needs seller financing.
In this particular scenario, market rates being 7.5%, he wanted to only pay 5% and thought the owner would take back paper for that.
But I mean, so was that an owner-occupier situation where the person buying it needed to use the building, or was that an investment? Because if you had 50% to put down, why wouldn't you put down less, invest the rest of that 50% elsewhere in a higher yield vessel and then take regular lending interest rates? If it's only a difference between like 125 basis points from the 5% he was asking from the seller versus, well, call it 150, a 6.5 or whatever. I don't know what he's getting, but that doesn't seem like a wide enough spread to justify putting a 50% down payment versus a 25% down payment.
I think in this particular situation, he was putting the half down and the spread was 2.5 points. So
2.5 points on $1.5 million is
yeah, and that created real
money.
A bigger,
it's almost $45,000 a year.
Gap for him to pencil the numbers in for the yield that he was going to give to his investors. It's just basically a lower cost of money. He was going to put $500,000 into play no matter what.
So generally speaking, a buyer is going to maybe request or ask for seller financing either to lower the down payment or lower the interest rates.
Correct.
Or if they're over-leveraged and can't get traditional lending.
Correct.
Okay. Are there any other scenarios where it makes sense for a seller?
A seller or a buyer?
A buyer.
Because we were just talking about a buyer.
A buyer.
Yeah, I mean, if they, like you had said, if they don't have the equity or if they don't have the ability to make a large down payment, if banks are just frozen like they are today, mm-hmm. some would argue that the numbers don't even matter today. The banks just are not lending money. So if the market is frozen in the traditional sense, then buyers would be forced into opportunities.
If the seller is willing to act as a bank, they're going to agree to a value without a third party saying it's worth this or it's worth that. Closing is going to be a lot quicker and faster and easier. And it just becomes a contractual agreement rather than having a third party such as a lender to underwrite the entire prospect.
Yeah, and I think there's been historically over the years plenty of seller finance deals that happened on the back of a napkin or a handshake, and you certainly can't do that with a traditional bank. So I'd say the other strong reason buyers like it is because it's simplistic.
And incredibly flexible in terms.
Yeah, you can make up any terms you want.
You can make up any terms that you want that don't have to fit into something that's going to be sold on a secondary market.
Or approved by some credit committee at a lending institution.
Mm-hmm.
So then also, you don't hear this often, but we have had clients in the past talk about entertaining lease-to-own opportunities. So how it sounds like it might be similar to like a land land contract, but what's the difference between a land contract that we've discussed and a lease-to-own agreement?
Yeah, I mean, I think lease-to-own gets thrown around as a general term, kind of like Kleenex and tissue. Like, it's generic, but at the end of the day, lease-to-own is simply a way of saying some portion of the payments that I'm making to lease the space are contributing or getting offset against what my future payment on the property is going to be. So if I'm in the same example, $3 million property, if I'm paying, you know, $300,000 a year in rent, some portion of that $300,000 is paying off my eventual purchase price of $3 million. So maybe, you know, I get to the end of a 10-year lease, and instead of having to buy the building for $3 million, I buy the building for $2 million or $2.5 million.
Yeah, the lease is an interest in time and does have a defined start date and a defined end date, whereas a land contract can go all the way, cradle to grave. Yeah. A land contract could also be a five-year installment period and a balloon payment. So it, you can, again, it's the flexibility. You can structure it anyway. But both of those go back to, I mean, the most important thing is, when does the actual title of the property transfer? And if someone defaults on a land contract, there is an argument that you would have to foreclose on them rather than just terminate the lease.
Yeah. Vice versa, actually. If there is a mortgage in place, you have to go through the foreclosure process. But in a land contract, if someone stops paying the bills, you literally just lock the doors and kick them out.
Yeah.
Now, depending on what state you're in, there are rules about what type of rights tenants have to possession. Pennsylvania, I mean, we could do a whole conversation about Pennsylvania's confession of judgment laws around possession.
Mm-hmm.
But
and I'm
as a general rule, way easier to get the occupancy of your property back if it was via a land contract than via a mortgage document.
And it doesn't apply to commercial properties, but an attorney's going to argue anything. In residential properties, if you did some kind of installment, you know, owner finance, you do have to comply with Dodd-Frank rules, which say that you do have to go through the foreclosure process, same as any bank would.
Yeah, so that was, I guess, my other question is, we understand, like, that we just talked about the pros for the buyer, where they could maybe reduce their down payment that a traditional bank might require, or they could get a better interest rate than a traditional lender might require. They, you know, with seller financing, you might not have the same kind of debt ratios that are going to be assessed by the seller as you would for a traditional lender, or if there's no lender availability. So those are like the upsides for the buyer in asking for seller financing. Mm-hmm. But is it riskier for the buyer to go through seller financing? Because we all know, like we talk about it a lot, the banks don't want to foreclose and repossess your property. But now you're talking
about banks.
Well, now you're talking about a former owner of this property who clearly at one time wanted to own this property, acting as the lender and then having the right under default to foreclose and repossess that property. So is that something that buyers put a lot of weight on when they're considering that, of like, hey, like I can't, this lender is not going to be as patient with me or as understanding with me as a traditional lender, because they might want to repossess the property after so many payments have been made. Does that get predatory ever?
Yeah, I mean, my gut tells me most buyers who are asking for seller financing wrongly assume or believe that it will be an easier relationship to finagle their way through, so that I bet they think there's less risk. They're like, oh, Joe owns the building. Joe's a good guy. He's not going to kick me out. He's not going to foreclose on me. We're just buddies. I think that's probably their perception, but I do think your opinion and comment is very astute that, yeah, more likely than not, Joe's like, sure, I'll do this. I'll get the property back. This will be great. And it's probably not what the buyer thinks is going to happen. But
and the bank is also under compliance rules, that there are procedures that they have to follow and laws that they can't break, whereas the owner of the property can be a lot more aggressive. And in addition to that, the bank, like I said, doesn't want to foreclose on the property, but they also have the resources to foreclose on the property, as well as the mandate to eventually get to that point.
Right.
And is that, why is that harder for, you're saying, when you say resources, you just mean like the desire and the capability financially and mentally to engage attorneys to go through the process?
Yeah, they have attorneys in place, and they also, in the mortgage document that they're going to have, they're going to have all sorts of triggers that allow you to, okay, the minute you default, I have an interest rate trigger, I'm going to start adding 2 points. If you've defaulted on it X amount of times, now your interest rate is not 7.5%, now it's 9.5%. And if that goes on for a period of time, well, now your interest rate is, instead of 9.5%, it's going to go to 11.5%. And that's all buried deeply into your mortgage documents. So at the end of the day, if you owed them $100,000, the final settling piece of it could be, you know, $180,000.
They've got a lot more reason to go. Enforce every letter of the contract than, you know, two unsophisticated parties where the seller's just trying to move the property, which I think is a good segue into why are sellers willing to do this.
Mm-hmm. And they're forced to because they have to comply. They can't have bad debt on their books for X period of time.
You mean the banks?
The banks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. But sellers historically and... would prefer not to take on financing. Like if I own something and I want to sell it for $3 million, just to keep the example going through the episode, like I want my $3 million today. Mm-hmm. But the reason that they might consider it is if the market's saying, you know what, we think we only want to pay $2.5 million for this property, but you, the seller, really believe it's worth three. You know, one way to get a buyer to pay more is to offer them some type of incentive, and that incentive could be, hey, I'll provide you financing.
Yeah, and there's an ease of doing that. And they also might ask for some kind of kicker that's above market rates. Doesn't always have to be below market. It's just an easier transaction to do. Say, this is the market. You're having a difficult time qualifying for it. Oh, so add 1.5 or 2 points, and now you'll pay me this interest rate.
And I think that in lies, like, it's all about leverage, right? So who has it and how they can use it to their advantage. Because we talked about the buyers wanting better terms, meaning less down payment, less interest rate. If I'm a seller and I have the good fortune of owning a piece of property without debt on it, and somebody comes to me and wants to buy it, but they want me to carry paper, is you know, a kind of slang way of saying... a land contract or seller financing, I'm going to say, you know what, if you can borrow money at 7.5% from PNC Bank, I kind of want 10% or 11%. Mm-hmm. Like, I want you to make it worth my while, because otherwise I'd rather you just go talk to PNC, figure it all out, mm-hmm. and give me my $3 million, because then I have the $3 million, I can go invest it in other things. If I provide seller financing, whether it's for 10% or 30% or 50% of the purchase price, those are dollars that I'm not going to see. Mm-hmm. I can't do anything with.
I also want to give you an incentive to pay me off quicker.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I absolutely want to do that. And so it's a tool in the tool bag, and I think you're going to probably see more of it as a hybrid or a combination of both of those things, where, you can place this amount, I can put 70% debt on, but I want another 10% on top of this, and I'll take a subordinate position. And the easiest way to do that is to make sure that the bank is eliminated entirely.
In, you know, your career, Michael, have you ever seen more seller financing requests than you're seeing today?
Mid-80s.
Okay. Yeah, mid-80s. I mean, I haven't.
When interest rates were significantly higher, it was just, you know, people were losing properties left and right. There were a lot of guys out there. And this is before properties went back. So you had developers that
when
knew
you
they
say
were
properties, and you mean to the bank.
Developers, they foreclosed on the properties. And they were just trying to get rid of them. They would do forms of owner financing. It was a kind of a cluster back then, too. And then it goes even further than that in the 70s, I'm going to say in the Carter years, because those, you saw a lot of residential transactions being done with that, because that would have been in, you know, interest rates climbed as high as 18-19%. And it was, you couldn't do a transaction without some augmented owner finance on it.
Yeah. So you also, earlier you mentioned recording the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably, before we get yelled at for running over time, the last thing that we should maybe talk about.
Yeah, I mean, if you're the seller and you do agree to do a land contract or a mortgage, we would contend it's really, really important that it's not on the back of the envelope and it's not a handshake, but it actually is a fully negotiated legal document with counsel's approval, and then that document gets recorded with the auditor for the municipality that you're in, because then it gives you standing. Like, it gives you the ability to go into a courtroom and say, we executed this document, we are all clear mind individuals, and we made these decisions. You know, real estate deals in general need to be in writing in order to be enforceable. So it's one thing to have a piece of paper that you both signed. It's a whole nother thing to have that piece of paper signed and then you take it to the county and say, hey, we want to put on record and we want everybody in the world to know, because it's searchable as a public document, that this transaction took place. These are the things we agreed to. So when things go bad, if they do, which unfortunately they do quite often, you have a case to be made to stand in front of a judge and say, but this was real and here's my proof.
And that agreement attaches to the land.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're on the seller side, okay, you do not want to convey title prior to your final payment. That's the most important thing. Again, you want to have firm terms. They want to be recorded. If you're on the buyer side, anything that you can do to get that title transferred up front, now the property is yours. And
you got a lot more standing.
You have a lot more standing, and you have a lot more just clout regarding it.
There's some wild case studies about buyers who got land contracts, thought they were making payments via their lease to buy a property. Then all of a sudden the owner calls him and says, I sold the property to Tom. And you're like, well, what do you mean you sold it to Tom? I've been paying my land contract thing. Like, I don't care. I sold it to Tom, and now Tom has the title.
Yeah,
and then you, as the person who didn't – like, there's a lot of people who don't want stuff recorded because they think that that protects them. But the reality is, even as a buyer, like, get it recorded so that then if
– oh, that's the ultimate protection, yes.
Yeah, right, so that if the seller is unscrupulous, you've got a chance to, you know – get your credits.
Yeah. And
so recording the mortgage is title transfer has to happen for the mortgage to be recorded.
No.
They're separate things.
No. Right? Separate things. Separate correct. Things,
yeah. So when Michael was saying you want the title to that property as soon as possible, that does not have anything to do with recording the mortgage.
Correct. It is a separate concept. But
title is transferred with a deed.
Yeah.
Okay. A mortgage is just a pledge of money for a debt, to repay a debt. Now, the other part is, if you're from the perspective of selling a property or buying a property, the best thing that can happen is to have only those two parties. Do not have a third party, such as a bank. The seller wants to be in first position, and I think the purchaser wants the seller in first position.
And all that's getting to is there's no limit on the number of layers of financing on a project. I mean, there's been some projects, especially with like historic tax credit deals, where there's 7, 8, 9. I think there's a project in Cleveland right now that's got 28 different mortgages on it, but only one mortgage holder, the first person, is kind of first in line to collect when things get paid out. So if you're the 28th person in line, chances of you getting anything is pretty limited.
Yes.
So as a lender or a seller financing something, you want to ensure you're as close to the top of the food chain as possible in order to be, you know, ensuring that you're going to get paid.
So the people that are lending at the bottom of the food chain in that circumstance, they're just charging a bajillion dollars in interest rates for the money? Like, why would you do that? Why would you be, like, the fifth or the tenth or the twelfth in line?
I would say one of a couple reasons, and then we'll talk about the bourbon and rap. But one reason would be it's a community project that you think is really, really important, and you as an organization think that the risks associated with not getting paid are worthy of the risk because you think the project needs to happen for some community benefit. You are going to charge a higher interest rate, so there's some benefit to that. You do get some brownie points, as a loose way of saying it, with the Federal Reserve for participating in things that otherwise wouldn't happen, but for your willingness to lend some money. You're friends with the person who's doing the project and you want to make it happen. Coupled with, there is, most banks have like a lending limit per borrower. So the project could be so big that the only way to make it happen is if multiple banks syndicate it
to other lenders,
that lending situation, because each bank on its own wouldn't be allowed to do the whole financing package.
Yeah, and this, I mean, a lot of times that insured loans, for example, loans that are insured by the government, the SBA is a perfect example of it. Some of their programs, they will let the primary lender be in first place for half the debt, so that in the event that this guy does fold, the primary lender is the guy that gets paid first, and the feds are the ones left holding the bag.
Right.
Yeah. So.
So that is seller finance in 30 minutes or less. Hopefully that was.
Can I just add one thing?
Exhilarating conversation.
Well, no, I think especially where we are today. Obviously, interest rates have had times that are just completely worse than where they are today. But it's really a nice tool to have, because that can be that final 10%, 15% piece of making a deal. Okay, if a seller is willing to take back some paper and you can knock out the original lender, it will work well for investors, it will work well for users, and it actually does work well for the actual sellers of the property. But it's just another piece of it, and you should have a firm understanding of what are the particulars as you're going through that part of the transaction. But if you can solve 15% of a deal, there's a pretty good chance that that would happen and would be a successful result.
Yeah, I mean, I think my end of the topic kind of takeaway is it's worthy of exploration.
Absolutely.
There's no downside to talking about it. Doesn't mean that it's right for everybody. We have crossed paths with some buyers and sellers who adamantly wouldn't even entertain it, which I think is short-sighted. I think it's worthy of at least exploring it. So speaking of exploration, what do you think, Michael? Old Forester 1870.
Okay, I love this bottle, and I've had more than my fair share of them. Old Forester is a great, great distiller. They have had history in America for a long period of time. If you're ever in Louisville, go to the distillery because it's spectacular. This is thumbs up in my book.
Great, Paige.
I'm drinking a 2019 Chablis.
Whatever that is.
Like the basic BIM these days.
BIM?
No.
What did you say?
I said like the basic BIM these days.
Oh, gotcha. Well, that's a wrap. Thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed it. Seller financing topic. And if you've got any questions or thoughts, give us a buzz. And again, like, love, thumbs up on all your channels out there, and spread the news. So Trade Secrets is out.